but I think it's a really good thing to bring this sort of ensemble into a space where maybe people are not used to hearing fully improvised music, and just taking them on a ride and giving them a new experience, because then it changes their concept of what music can be, especially in a live setting. What is composition, you know, and what is chamber music? Like, then it just broadens that scope of what the imagination, you know, can kind of dream of in that sense. So I like that a lot. And I think it's important to do that, you know, because then people remind themselves to be engaged because they're part of a unique moment, rather than being somewhere because they know what they're going to receive.
And during that time, I really found comfort and stillness and flow by picking up the loom.
This is a special episode of my podcast, celebrating Volume 1 with my improvising ensemble, Collected Strands. The other musicians in the group have all been featured previously on this series, and you'll find the links to those episodes in the show notes, with cellist Raphael Weinroth-Brown, pianist James McGowan, and drummer Micah Sudri. I'm also delighted that you will get to know the inspiring Australian artist, educator, and author, Marianne Moody, whose woven art graces the cover of this album. You'll find the links to her work in the show notes as well. I'm also releasing the interview with Marianne as a separate standalone bonus episode connected to this episode. I feel that all my listeners who love music and creativity will find that Marianne's personal journey and perspectives will resonate strongly with them, and I hope some listeners in the weaving and art world will also be inspired by the musicians. We are including excerpts from the album during this episode, and you'll find all the links to buy and stream this music in the description. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Cold, and you can use the detailed timestamps to navigate the episode. Before we jump into our conversation, I want to let you know that I have a new way you can support this independent podcast through a beautiful collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly. You'll find that link in the description of the episode. This weekly podcast is in season 4, and I send out an email newsletter where you can get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including the store for the very cool shirts, mugs, and more, and the support link to buy this independent podcaster a coffee. So this was really, for me, it's such a new thing, and you've guided me all along the way. I was very ignorant about this whole process, and I just thought you stick a mic, you record some stuff, and you have an album. I didn't know about all these steps, so I really appreciated all the hand-holding, all the many steps. So our first tracks were recorded back last July in extreme heat. Do you remember how hot it was in that church?
It was. No air conditioning, of course.
I remember, like, it's hard to shift and hold your violin sometimes when it's that hot, and of course we couldn't have fans on. But I thought, well, I'm improvising, so I don't have to do, you know, I can choose what I play to be comfortable in this heat. So that kind of helped. I didn't have to play something set.
Improvising is so cool because you can respond entirely to the environment. It's not only like the heat, which is a big thing, but it's also the audience that you're in and the type of music they want to hear. So, you know, the heat is just one contributing factor to being totally engrossed in the moment. an album can't capture that as much because it's like it's recording. You don't see the whole context, but I think the music comes across as being, you know, complete and integrated in response to the environment that we were in.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned in response to what the audience wants to hear. A couple of tracks on this album were actually from a live concert that we did last November. That was a different experience for sure.
It was. I think, you know, I listened to this knowing the context of which tracks come from the recording session and which were in front of an audience. I think the audience has more vitality, more life to it. With the audience, though, it really does. You pick up on, like, we're engaging with the audience, and we can feel the intensity increase, and we can feel that coming back from the audience. And I'm hoping that the listener will hear that too, because I certainly felt that, and I think you did too, in the performance with an audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did do a recent podcast episode with you in depth. In fact, all members of the quartet, so I'll point people to those. We didn't really talk about, besides jazz, the different kind of improvisation you've played. I'm curious, the type of improvisations that we're doing in different styles. Have you done this sort of thing before?
I've done more, I would call it classical or non-style specific improvisation, you know, my whole life. When I was a teenager, I played a lot of Mozart sonatas, a lot of classical repertoire, and I tried improvising in that style, and I got pretty good at it, and I started exploring the romantic styles. I paid my way through university by, you know, doing church music direction, leadership, and I improvised music all the time, and a lot of times I didn't play jazz in those contexts, and sometimes I did, and it was very much appreciated. But I love improvising in classical styles. And when I say classical, I mean in the broadest sense, that it not being jazz specific. So that's something I've always done, and I love doing it.
What we'll do is we're going to include a couple of complete tunes, well, if you want to call them that, creations, and then we'll include some clips from different ones just to give people a taste of the whole album. I thought maybe we could have a clip from our very opening tune, which we called Unsettled Night.
Well, first of all, I love how we were able to create this mood and sustain it, and it grows and it morphs, and we were able to sustain the mood too, and I thought we did a great job in that. When we do improvisation, collective improvisation is always, I think, one of the hardest things to do is to start, like, who starts? And we often just sit there for several seconds, like, looking at each other, who's going to start? In this piece, I started something. And then I developed something, and I didn't know who was going to pick up on it. But as soon as you and Raph start playing, it's like, oh, I know where this is going. And then you don't really know exactly where it's going, but you have a sense collectively where we're going to go. And I thought this was a really captivating opener for the album. And I think, you know, this is, you're saying, us working together. I think you do a fantastic job on this track with your engagement with Raph, especially. Mike does some wonderful rhythmic things in the background. We're playing off each other, but I do like the interaction you have with Raph on this one.
Thank you.
A short excerpt from Unsettled Night.
Thank you.
This is great. We got all of us together at the same moment. So I'm so excited for this album release. James had spoken very specifically to quite a few of the tracks we're going to be sharing. We're going to be sharing some clips and a couple of complete tracks. But I thought it'd be nice if you guys want to just reflect on the process, the kind of music we're playing, your experience with it. So Mike, you use some kind of different extended techniques sometimes when you're playing with us.
The bow. I use a bass bow. It's a bass bow. It's great because it's certainly visually as a drummer. It's look at what's the drummer doing with a bow? You know, what's he doing? And also, it just when you bow, it's for cymbals. And when you bow the cymbal, you get a pitch that you have no idea what it's going to be. I think a lot of times when we used it in this setting, it worked out, like the pitch that I got. It's like, oh, that worked out. It was this. Sometimes I get a really low pitch underneath everything that's happening. It's like, oh, wow, that's recontextualizes everything that's happening above. So that's always a really cool thing. And sometimes it just gets right in there with what you guys are playing on the cello and violin. It's really neat. It gets right in that space. It's like, oh, what's... And then also that sort of recontextualizes sound as well. It's just like, oh, is that the violin or is that the violin? What's what? You know, so it's kind of an interesting that way. It's an interesting thing to use.
I think it added a lot. I really like that part of it when you use that for the timbre. But the randomization of the pitch is also cool because then we can explore the sounds and, right. and it can actually guide us in a different direction.
Right.
And it becomes very interactive.
Yeah, it's a neat sound for sure.
And it's fun for me playing a primarily melodic instrument that some of our tracks get very percussive. So I'm doing a lot of hitting with my bow and different kinds of effects. Chaotic Kittens. It's quite a short track. Maybe we can include the whole thing. It's very percussive. It has this chromatic sensibility and high energy. It's a nice contrast to some of the more meditative tracks we have, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. We explored lots of different things, you know, and what I love about this track that we did is that it's intentionally, we're throwing away tonality, we're throwing away any sense of logic, and yet there's a really fascinating sense of coherence in the chaotic nature of what we did. And we all picked up on the energy. We want to go high, we want to intensify. And you know, I don't think we took it too seriously, but it holds together musically. And so I think us naming it afterwards as Chaotic Kittens, it's a silly name, but it captures the lighthearted nature of that type of energy. And I have to say one more thing about this piece. Mike's big dramatic percussive hit near the end is like, I literally jumped after he played that.
Yeah.
And I think you hear my hands fall down the piano as a result of me falling down from that jump. That was a lot of fun to do that piece.
Yeah. And I think our recording engineer, Dean Watson, named it Chaotic Kittens when he heard it.
I think so. Like Dean and I and all of us contributed some interesting names to these pieces.
It's my favorite title that we came up with.
This is a short excerpt of Chaotic Kittens.
So, Mike, I've got a question for you. the whole idea of playing a groove-based pattern that you would expect typically on drums is you do that obviously at times when we're going in that direction, but often you're playing very very of course rhythmically, but not necessarily as a time-based right. thing, more of a textural and timbral type of approach. So I wonder if you could speak to that and how it interacts with the ensemble.
It's very interesting. Improvising is it because it for me, and maybe it's just the way I approach the instrument or what it generally does is as a supportive thing. I, in a weird way, I almost never improvise in a way, because whatever music I'm in, it always tells me what to do. So when there's strong time, or when there's something that really refers to something that has very, very strong time, I'm somewhat compelled to play that strong time. So sometimes when we're playing I'm not going to do that. I'm going to play time because it's very clear like that there's time happening, but I'm going to try and do it in some other way that is not, you know, very obvious. So I want to play time, but I want to play it in a timbral way where I'm adding to the timbre. Like if there's time already happening, I don't know if I need, do we need more obvious time? When things start happening and there's an expectation, like say there's a chord change that's happening, like if there's 1-4 and 1-5 that is happening, this is okay. Well, that's very clear that is going to happen in some of our improvisations. So it's okay. Well, I'm going to make it, is it going to happen? Maybe it isn't going to happen. The drummer's not saying that is going to happen. So I was like, wait, maybe I can delay that expectation or foggy that expectation a little bit, you know, so that everything that happens is not super predictable in a way. So it's like, oh, okay, well, what's the drummer doing? There's something there's some salt in the wheel there. I don't know. That's some of the way I approach stuff as well. So, and the main thing is, you know, when I'm improvising, for sure, it's the music, certainly rhythmically and timbrally, the music will always tell me what to do. So if I'm playing straight ahead jazz and stuff, and I'm improvising away, it's like, okay, well, I'm listening. Okay, well, there's more. This player is playing with more space and stuff like that. I'm gonna jump. Either I'm going to do one of two things. I'm going to go with that, or I'm going to fill those spaces sometimes. Or, you know, I will definitely ask the person who I'm playing with, you know, do you like more drums or less drums? You know, like, you know, because you can be very sparse or very active. So sometimes you'll ask those questions. You know, music in any ensemble, the music will tell you what to do. If there's no music, then, you know, if there's no sound, then that's telling you something too. Okay, don't play. Or if you play, make it sound really excellent. Silence is golden, and it's a hard thing to have to break, you know?
So Mike, you mentioned a really interesting thing that you when you say that you're not really improvising. And to me, that's a really interesting perspective, because all we're doing when we're improvising is drawing upon what we already know and right. responding to the context that we find ourselves in. So,
yeah.
You know, that's the perspective it's I've like, got.
Yeah.
I have seen other improvisation groups, and they'll just literally say Improv 1, Improv 2. So I'm glad we took the time to find some titles. And you really took it upon yourself to be the primary person to create the set list and the flow of the album. I really thank you for all the time you put into that. What kind of creative flow does that create for you, that kind of work?
So to me, there's the true joy is in creating the music. But then we have these recordings, and it's like, With these recordings, we can do so much with them. We can share them. But I think curating what we've done is one of the most important things we can do to share the breadth that we do and the depth that we do. So curating it, like, sure, it takes some time to pick pieces, you know, sort them out. And in some cases, some of them were longer, but there was a little gap in there. So we maybe trim off some of it to find what seems to me like a really coherent statement, a coherent piece of music that holds together. So I really love that that process. And it was a lot to work with. I improvised myself on my own, and yet collaborating with great musicians who bring whole new ideas to the table is a real thrill for me. And every improv group that I play with, regardless of style, brings a whole different energy and bunch of creative ideas. So this group is kind of unique in how we blend the genres, and the instrumentation itself is unique. So I really found this to be a lovely challenge to come up with some programs and some set lists. And then the flow of how the pieces connect. And we all worked on the titles, but coming up with titles that capture the main sense of what we're doing musically, even if it's not this exactly, like it's just a metaphorical representation of the sound. But yeah, I think we all contributed to creating something, but it was just a joy for me to contribute some more in putting that together with everyone's input.
Yeah, well, speaking of contrasting styles, I think I'll play a clip from Baroquinerie is what we ended up calling it. And often, like, I'm not thinking words when we're doing this kind of work, but I remember just thinking maybe something Baroque, and I just started playing, you know, and that just kind of came out that way.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did that start, because it started us on a wonderful different trajectory.
Yeah.
You're about to hear a short excerpt from Baroquinerie.
You do a lot of improvisation in different styles, but with Collected Strands, it is different, right?
Yeah, I think with every group of musicians, it's different. It's easy to say that on paper, a group of musicians should play well together in an improvised context, but I don't think that's necessarily true. But I think that when we play together, there's very little expectation going into any piece, and I think that's part of what makes it good. I think that there's not too much communicated. Sometimes there's a directive, but in general, we follow where the music takes us. And I think inevitably that's what happens. But I would say in terms of how I contribute as an individual, I think I'm always prone to like switching roles as a cellist. I kind of don't really see myself as a musician that occupies one role in an ensemble, if that's like on a recording or live. I'm just thinking more about the overall piece and like where there's space and what could potentially be cool in a certain part of any composition. So I tend to sort of jump around because I think that there's a really nice sort of there's a nice space for the natural melodic register of the cello that always sounds good here. But I also like being really textural or being really rhythmic and feeling like there's a lot of room for that. And because also we're swapping sometimes in terms of the type of material that we're playing, yeah, it creates a lot of opportunities to try different things and to not always use the same tools in every piece, but maybe to make the instrument, have the instrument play a different character every time that we create something from scratch. So I think it's like a very different context for me than any other group that I've played in as an improviser. But honestly, I think I've had some of my most enjoyable moments playing in this group because I feel like there's so little pressure to sound a certain way or to create a certain result. And that's very freeing, actually.
So, Raph, do you have any questions for any of us?
Yeah, I guess for everyone, really, do you feel that that as a group that we enter a kind of flow in some of the pieces that we've played, or have there been moments where it's a bit tricky to navigate and you're unsure of whether the music itself was good? And how often does the experience that one feels while playing actually align with how it sounds when you listen back? Because sometimes I feel like the experiences are different. You know, the way you feel about the music in the moment is different sometimes from how it actually is. So I'd be curious to hear everyone's thoughts on that.
For me, there's select moments where I'm just really doubting my contribution or what, and then I get in my own head a little bit. Usually those are pretty transitory. And when I listen back, of course, it's never as bad as you think. In general, that's the case with these things. But for me, I'm able to get into a great flow with you guys, and it's really the, yeah, it's the joy.
Yeah. Raph, also, those are great points. When I listen back, it's also it's a different experience than when I'm playing it, because where I'm physically located and what I actually hear is different than what the mics are picking up. One of the most important things for me being in the zone, I guess you could say, and where in the sense that I can be fully responsive and contributory with the music that's being created, is being able to hear everything accurately. In some of our sessions, you know, I might not hear you, Raph, a little bit enough. So, I mean, I hear you and have to play, but when we're all playing full on, like maybe I don't hear you exactly in precisely the way as I want. So hearing back is going to be different than when I created it. And same with Mike too, like in a different part of our conversation, you mentioned that sometimes you play more textually and timbrely and less with a groove. And when you're playing with the groove, it seems pretty clear. But when you're playing textually and timbrely, like, oh, is he playing? And then I have to concentrate even more deeply. He's doing that thing. And so it leads me to do another thing. So there's a lot of thinking in the moment of what the ensemble is creating and my contribution to it. And Lay points out there's some self-doubt that takes place too. But in the end, we all have to be 100% in the moment to achieve the unique direction of that particular piece in that particular moment. And then listening back, it's like, oh, yeah. And sometimes it really works. And sometimes it's like, okay, like, oh, there was an opportunity there we didn't take up. But for the most part, it's I'm really happy with what this group can create.
I mean, creating in the moment is always, it's great. It's always great. And then being really committed to that and defying expectations, I guess, you know, it's like, oh, like, because everybody, you know, even listeners will expect something, expect what this is going to come next. This is going to come next, you know, and they'll know it somehow. So it's always good to sort of, no, we're not going to go there. No, let's not go there. Let's not go there. Let's go there. Let's go there. Let's go there. You know, and just have it. have it be wide, you know. And sometimes if I, to your point, James, is being able to hear everybody, because there's a large disparity in volume, you know, in terms of our instruments acoustically. So if I start hitting a groove too hard, then I've lost all of you. then I don't hear any of you. So that's sometimes, that's a lot of times why I never hit hard time. Because and then the other thing too is if I have to hit it, if I'm playing time, I want to play it strongly. Like I want to commit to it, right? Commit to a sound. But if I can't do that, so it's like, okay, I'm going to do something else. You know what I mean? I don't want to lose you guys. You know, like I don't want to, I'm sure you can follow me, but it's, I don't want to, like, okay, I'm playing the drums, but now I can see you guys waving your arms, but I'm not hearing anything coming from you guys because, you know, I'm too loud. So anyway, and that's another thing that I always do is I'm always trying to play to a volume that I can still hear you guys. That's always another balance thing. So as quiet as you guys are playing, might be playing, I'm going to try and go there. Like I'll try and so that I can still hear you guys. That's just my natural reaction is matching volume. That's a natural.
That's an interesting point about the groove, actually, because I feel that if we get too strongly into a groove or become too overtly rhythmic, like what can happen is that it's difficult to hear when the music is going somewhere else, or it's also difficult to transition out of
That's
it.
That's right.
And so there's always this state of like being ready for anything. It could go in any direction. And so it requires this sensitivity of like always kind of being on your toes, knowing that, you know, we might be in a certain rhythm or like ostinato, some kind of flow that's happening, but then it could easily change at any moment. And so that it means like playing too hard sometimes, you can actually overcommit also. Yeah. Which is an interesting thing with just, I think, this type of configuration. But I also like the fact that I don't feel the need to lock in every note in the pocket in a certain way. Like in other groups that I've played in before, it becomes super obvious that like maybe my playing is too free actually, and that it doesn't land in the groove in the way that would best suit the music, you know, during a solo, let's say, or an improvised passage. But here I think it benefits the music actually when all of us are more free, because it gives it more uniqueness, it creates more freedom for everybody when each person does that, actually, I think. So that's a really nice thing. And so in that sense, there's fewer, there's no wrong answers, but it makes every gesture more meaningful in a way, I think.
Right.
No, I was just thinking, it's the first time the four of us have actually sat down and talked about what we do.
I think the music speaks louder than words, though. I think we're all thinking about these things, and we're communicating with sharing these ideas through music. And so I think that's fundamentally where we've been going. And the idea of time, I want to pick up on your thoughts here. When I play classical music, like, you know, something like Chopin or something, there's going to be this natural ebb and flow of, you know, accelerating, decelerating. But the tempo remains more or less the same. But the music dictates it to have some breathing room. And so I, you know, if we were to record, I would, with this group, I would never want to use a click, you know, a metronome in our ears, because it would defeat the whole purpose of having that freedom as we're discussing. But, you know, you can have good sense of time and be ahead or behind of the beat. Because we're always doing this listening. And I call this empathetic listening, because we're always responding to what each of us are presenting, if not what there is intended, but what we're receiving. And I think that flexibility to adapt and go with that is one of the great things of having four musicians where we each trust each other and have respect for each other's, you know, musical statements and ideas.
In terms of, you know, branding and how, you know, you have to use tags nowadays to attract people to your music. And I was actually comparing different similar albums and the tags they're using, because I thought also we have quite a broad range of styles on this album. You know, people use the word chamber jazz. It can mean a lot of different things. What we're doing is certainly not jazz in any traditional sense. We're not playing over chord changes. But for a lot of listeners, that might be one of the closer genres they're used to associating it with.
I think it's a real shame that people think that improvisation, oh, jazz. Sure, jazz thrives with improv, but improvisation is, as we know, who studied music, was the cornerstone of how Baroque music, you know, worked, and composers and performers, the divisions between those labels were blurred until the 19th century. And then only in the recent years, you know, last several decades, are we starting to challenge that. So there's a sense that if we tag our music as being jazz, we miss out on the traditions that we're drawing upon. I think you came up, Leah, with the idea of calling it improvised chamber music.
Yeah.
Yeah, improvised chamber music. And I think that's great, because chamber music doesn't have to be classical. And this isn't fully classical, but certainly embraces many of those traditions. But it is chamber music. And it's one thing that's for sure. This is not orchestral, and it's not solo. It's chamber music. And so that's 100%, and it's improvised. So that's a proper name. And I'm glad you came up with that, because I was thinking, should we call it improvised classical music? Because it's not. It's improvised classical / Middle Eastern / touches on jazz / folk. It becomes unwieldy to hear that many titles. Chamber music captures it all.
Yeah. And a couple of our pieces, like Chaotic Kittens, that are more atonal, people in the past would have used the term avant-garde. And now I would just call that contemporary art music, you know. Mm-hmm. There's all these blurs.
Sometimes drawing upon a different mode adds some different color changes. So the mixolydian mode, where we flat the seventh scale degree of a major scale, and then we all sort of play with that for a while. Another piece where we looked at was, I think it's called Summer's Eve, that we came up in, that we create this like almost like a tango-like feel, and that evolved through the rhythmic interplay that we were creating, and it just ended up being this boom, ba boom. It was really fun rhythmic, and so there's these different ways of creating these environments.
You're about to hear a short excerpt from Summer's Eve. Now you're going to hear my interview with the artist Marianne Moody, whose weaving is featured on the cover of this album. You'll find the links to Marianne's art, workshops, and books in the description of this podcast, and this interview is also featured as a standalone bonus connected to this main episode.
I do feel that all my listeners who love music and creativity will find that Marianne's personal journey and perspectives will resonate strongly with them. After this interview, there's lots more with the musicians and the album.
So, Marianne, it's so nice to meet you.
Thank you, Leah. It's lovely to meet you too.
This is very unusual for this podcast to have somebody on the podcast who's not primarily a musician. But thank you for contributing to our album in this important way, and hopefully our next album as well, with our name Collected Strands.
I actually do feel like my loom is a little bit like a harp, so there is a connection.
I think there's a lot of connections, actually, and so many creative people I speak with, I think there's just so many commonalities. But let's talk about your work and how people can get in touch with you. And you do so much, really, for community of weavers, new weavers and experienced weavers all over.
Thank you. I feel like community is the sort of the center of my practice. I am often alone in my studio when I'm weaving, either listening to music or podcasts, or just alone in my thoughts. And that connection to other weavers, other artists, other humans, presently, as well as those in the past, is so important to my practice and to making me feel like I'm in the right spot.
Mm-hmm. So you have two books.
Yes. I was a teacher for 10 years before I started weaving, and so that part of my identity is still really strong. And so it was an organic pathway that I started, once I started weaving, that I wanted to share that knowledge and that feeling of being centered and having a creative outlet with other people who were looking for that but didn't quite have the railings in place to help them. So I really wanted to give people that first, you know, gentle guidance into having an artistic outlet. And so I wrote my first book, and that was a huge success. And so the publishers came back and asked me to write a second one. And the second one was really building on the first one and more for pure weavers, whereas the first one was just having an artistic life, having a sustainable artistic creative life.
Mm-hmm. So were you teaching school?
Yeah, I was teaching primary school or elementary school, and I spent a lot of my time teaching in the art room. And I always had a creative outlook, I guess, with my life. But then I found that when I was teaching, I was allowing other people to experience that joy, and I wasn't allowing myself. And so once I was pregnant, I found I had more time on my hands to be able to nurture my own inner artistic child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm a parent as well. My kids are grown, but I have thought over the years, if you model, especially as a woman, I think if you model your having your own passions that you're interested in, that's a good thing for them to see, so that they're not necessarily always the focus of your life.
Oh, absolutely. I think very early on, I had a therapist who gave me the keys to life, which was, you are not just a mother. You are not just a mother of a child who is neurodiverse. You are also an artist, a dancer, a daughter, a sister, a friend. You know, you contain multitudes. And that just allowed me to take the pressure off parenting and to really just be fully myself. And that, I think I agree with you, because it's important for my kids to see that I'm not just the person who's at home waiting and, you know, being at their beck and call, I guess, that I also have my own important life.
So how did you get into weaving specifically?
So I used to sell vintage clothes when I was little. I grew up the youngest of six kids, and we were really poor, you can imagine, you know, rich in love and friendship, but poor in money. And we would go to the charity shops, the op shops they call them here in Australia, and we would just find treasures in there. And they were all links to the past. They were all stories, other people's stories that had, if you found the good stuff, then it would have had many lives before it came to you. And it would have more lives as you finished with it and passed it on to the next person, whether that was clothing, books, toys, costumes, fabrics, home furnishings. And so I got really good at finding and nurturing these beautiful stories and these objects and these fabrics and clothes. And I created a side business while I was teaching, which was selling, you know, or rehoming a lot of these precious objects. And one of the things that I loved about it was this link to the past. Mm-hmm. And so as I was moving through looking for my own artistic outlet beyond that, I found I was drawn to the loom because it had all of those stories. It had other weavers' hands. I was able to use yarns and fibers that other people had created with love, and they had put their own stories into it, and I was able to create something and then pass it on to the next person. So I felt like there was still an organic link between what I had been doing and what I found at the loom. I had maternity leave in Australia. We're very, very privileged and fortunate to have paid leave by the government, and you can take it at half pay, so you can have longer time, less money. And during that time, I really found comfort and stillness and flow by picking up the loom when I wasn't with my baby. And by sharing that online with other people, I found that I was able to make connections, which is my favorite part, with other people while I was at home alone with my baby. I was still able to reach out. So then it just moved on from there, from having that connection and then teaching other people how to do it, and then selling my artworks, writing the books. I've got some online classes and I do workshops as well.
Mm-hmm. So when you use recycled yarn, you're literally taking sweaters apart, or is that how you started with that?
Yeah, I did. So I can, you can either reclaim wool and natural fibers, which is, you know, it's a whole process in itself, which I love. It creates a stillness in my life. But then also creating fibers from, so I had my nana's, I was given, when she passed away, I was given some of her beautiful clothes. And there was, you know, she had these silk blouses. And I had them sort of tucked away in my closet and I hadn't worn them. And I really felt a bit guilty. And I was thinking maybe I could get them tailored and they weren't really my style. And so I created, using the silk shirts, I created long ribbons, long silk ribbons. And I used those to weave an artwork that now sits pride of place in my home by the door. And I get to think about her. Hi, Nana. Every time I pass the piece, rather than just in the drawer. And I did the same thing with my maternity jeans. Okay. I created a denim artwork that hangs in my boys' room. So it's sort of finding memory and meaning in things that otherwise might end up in landfill or lost, and really harnessing that into art.
Mm-hmm. So your pieces that I've seen, I really like the incorporation of the natural world, and also the pieces you do, which are all one tone, you know, all neutral or all black. Very, very cool, because you use such texture, more 3D.
Right. Yeah, I've been weaving now for almost 12 years. So my first boy is 12 this year. And over those 12 years, I've had a lot of time to explore different pathways and have different seasons in my own life that called for different expressions. And so I'll often sit you know, I do have commissions, and when I have a commission, then I will work with that person, that client, to bring their vision to life and their story, because we're working together to create something that's going to hopefully be a family heirloom, live on their walls for a long time. So I want them to really feel connected to those pieces. But when I'm working on pieces for myself, I try to make sure that there is, the only intention is to listen to myself and to explore with my hands different fibers, try to do the opposite to what I normally do, or, you know, do some sketches and try to pull out motifs from the sketches that I see. And so I feel really privileged that now I have a bank of different styles that I can refer to, and I know that they represent different parts of my life. And for me, the magic is in the actual creating of the item and the creating of the art in the moment. And so once I've created it, it's almost, it's left me, and that art can be moved on to somebody else's story and somebody else's interpretation. And so something that for me meant, showed how I was feeling during the lockdowns, during COVID in Melbourne, for somebody else, it can represent a real freedom and an openness and a softness. And I love that with art, that when I put my intention into it, my viewer might have a totally different story at the other end. That's magic.
It is, yeah. One of the singers I interviewed, I can't remember which one it was. I don't want to say the wrong person. And I remember her saying that if she tells what her lyrics are about before she sings the song, then people don't get to have their own interpretation. So sometimes it's better for them to wait and hear what her intention was. And it doesn't really matter if they had took something different from it.
Yeah, I wonder, are you the kind of person who likes to read the, you know, when you go to an art gallery, do you read the, now do you read that before or after you really take time to look at the piece?
Kind of depends. I like to have context, but I mean, it would maybe look at it first and then read and then go back and look a little bit.
I feel like that's the right thing to do, especially listening to this singer's idea. But I more often than not, I will go and read the read the little card first, and then go and look at the piece and try to see what the artist has done. But I like that idea of having your own feelings first before. I always feel like they're so learned and they're so professional. If they've got their work up in the art gallery, they would know, wouldn't they?
Mm. So through the Well, through the internet, have you met fiber artists in different disciplines and been inspired by stuff they do that's very different than yours, maybe different techniques or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the internet has always been, I know it can always be, it can everywhere can have its darkness, but I do feel like the fiber community and the craft community and even a lot of art networks can have a real positivity and support to them. Mm-hmm. I very rarely find any, you know, negative comments or people trying to create unnecessary drama. And there is a lot of support, women supporting women and sharing our resources. And with a discipline like weaving, there is a lot of skills in there, and there isn't a lot of gatekeeping in our craft, in modern weaving. There's a sort of that idea of a women's circle and sharing your skills to be passed along, that we don't really own any of this. We're very lucky and privileged to be able to hold it and work with it and even make a living from it before we pass it along to the next person. Mm-hmm. I do find that I try to constantly unfollow people. Like, I'll follow them for a short time and then unfollow. I have some core people who are actually my friends in real life that I've met. But I find that if I follow too many fiber artists, then my work can be, you know, it can sort of tilt into being inspired by other people's work. And so I try to make sure that I'm constantly taking you know, taking a break from looking at other people's work to make sure that I'm really listening to myself and telling my own story.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Well, it was just such a pleasure to meet you, and this is going to be so cool to edit this into the special podcast episode celebrating Collected Strands. And of course, the links to everything Marianne Moody Weaving will be in the description of this episode.
Thank you so much, Leah. I've loved getting to know you, and this opportunity is really exciting, bringing both of our disciplines together.
Thanks.
Thanks, Leah.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. I wanted to let you know that I have a new way you can support this independent podcast through a beautiful collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly. You'll find that link in the description of the episode. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media and share my posts, and if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing. You'll find that link in the show notes along with the merch store. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now, back to the episode. I just thought it might be interesting to close this out to reflect a little bit on the audience. So most of these tracks were recorded in a very hot, empty church last summer, and then some of them were part of a live concert. And we've played a few live concerts, and the feeling, well, having talked to audience members afterwards, people are surprised by how excited they were, not knowing what to expect at every moment, that experience. So I'm hoping this does translate in the recording we made. Certainly I've listened to these tracks many times now, and it's surprising to me how fresh they are every time for me. Do you guys want to reflect on the audience and maybe the kind of listeners that might be surprised by this music?
I think every audience is different, and I think the audience informs the performance as much as our mood on that day or the conditions, the venue. I know, I think sometimes on some of our shows that James has spoken to that, actually, that, you know, the audience is part of the show. And I really believe that to be true. But I think it's a really good thing to bring this sort of ensemble into a space where maybe people are not used to hearing fully improvised music, and just taking them on a ride and giving them a new experience, because then it changes their concept of what music can be, especially in a live setting. What is composition, you know, and what is chamber music? Like, then it just broadens that scope of what the imagination, you know, can kind of dream of in that sense. So I like that a lot. And I think it's important to do that, you know, because then people remind themselves to be engaged because they're part of a unique moment, rather than being somewhere because they know what they're going to receive. That's like, there's almost like a social aspect to going to a concert, because you know, oh, they're playing this composer, or you know their music, and that, you know, kind of like it's part of the cultural zeitgeist or whatever, and like that you should be there, you know. Instead, it's like you don't know what you're going to get every time, and you're part of that, and it forces you to be present because you don't get to relive that experience. It's, you know, you're part of it. And so I think that's great. And like, personally, it relieves a lot of pressure also to not feel the need to recreate a past performance or experience. Sometimes I still feel that in a way. It's like, oh, yeah, we had a good show the other day. Oh, I would like this show to be equally good, if not better. But ultimately, you have to let that go, I think. And I think that, you know, when we recorded our show last November, I guess it was, like, I think it added an extra energy to the pieces. And I really like what we came up with on the show, at least as much, I think, as what we did when it was just us in the church alone. So I think it plays a big role, you know, the audience is maybe, yeah, a musician too.
For sure. There's no espresso machines growing in the background either. It's good.
True that.
Yeah, I'll also say that the audience that comes, it makes a big leap of faith to come to a concert that's with has based on improvisation, because they don't know what to expect. And as far as I could tell, every member of the audiences that we've had have gone with us for the ride. So I think that speaks to what we're able to create, but it's, you know, with our successful creation of Where It Can Go, but also to the audience, what Raph is referring to, that they are stretching their minds, going in with little expectation. We're not going to a Beethoven show. We're not going to a tribute to John Coltrane show. We're going to something that we don't know what will happen. So there is a lot to be said for an audience who will do that. But when they make that commitment and they get that new experience, then now they have a whole new perspective of what music can be. And I think that's a collaborative building. We're creating community of trust and of deep listening and of this sense of freedom of creation. And I think that's, I think we're all contributing to a nice sense of community here.
So some of the music that we wrote, it captures different modes and different style expressions. So one of the pieces that we had was, I started thinking, well, let's just create like not in a major or minor key. And yet the music is very approachable. That most of the music, well, all the music that we play is compelling in some form. But we tried to make sure that it's accessible to a general listener. There's always, we often have this concept of the melody being presented, and sometimes these harmonic progressions that might even be understood and heard before. Sometimes drawing upon a different mode adds some different color changes. So the mixolydian mode, where we flat the seventh scale degree of a major scale, and then we all sort of play with that for a while. Another piece where we looked at was, I think it's called Summer's Eve, that we came up in, that we create this like almost like a tango like feel, and that evolved through the rhythmic interplay that we are creating, and it just ended up being this boom, boom, boom. It's just, it was really fun rhythmic, and so there's these different ways of creating these environments. A Simple Magic and The Long Journey Home are the two tracks that we have that are from the live album, sorry, with the audience. So The Long Journey Home is the one where we have this journey from textual and rhythmic, finding some harmony, building the energy and the ending together. It just seemed like a natural evolution of a journey. And then A Simple Magic is really that. It was a simple chord progression. Everyone allowed, you and Raph being allowed to have that space to have your melody soar. And I think we came together with a beautiful, you know, a gentle kiss at the end of the album, like by choosing this piece to end all the tracks.
Well, thanks so much for this today, James. It was really fun.
Well, yeah, thank you so much as well, because it was a lot of fun to work on this together. Raph has brings so much. Mike brings so much, and this collectively we find this sound, and I think that sound is what we want to share with as many people who are, you know, interested to explore the improvised music traditions. Thank you.
Beautiful. Well, thanks, guys.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. You'll find that link in the show notes along with the merch store. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Have a wonderful week.